Is the Me Too movement enough?
For me, until or unless we're willing to engage in that conversation about the deconstruction of patriarchy, then this movement may not develop the roots that I think it rightly deserves.
That's Rob Okun. We spoke with him in 2014 about his book, Voice Male, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. Today, we air part of that 2014 interview, but first we talk with Okun about hashtag MeToo and hashtag Time's Up, and how men can support that movement. Then, the pioneering science fiction writer Ursula K. Le Guin died on January 23rd. We air our 2012 interview with her about her short story anthology, The Unreal and the Real. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Over a million people marched nationwide on January 20th in the second Women's March of the Trump era. I went to the march in New York City. There were about 200,000 people there, most of them women, of course, but I was thrilled and surprised to see so many men and boys carrying feminist signs and wearing pink pussy hats. And I would guess that the hashtag MeToo movement played some part in that. Women are waking up to their power, and men are waking up to a new kind of solidarity with women. Or more men, should I say. Because what my guest Rob Okun calls the pro-feminist men's movement has been around for about 3 decades now. And he was one of the founders. We'll hear later from my 2014 interview with him about the collection of essays he edited, Voice Male, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. He's just come out with an updated edition of the book. But first, last week we spoke via Skype about Me Too and Time's Up and what that means for men as well as for women. Well, Rob Okun, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's nice to be here.
So now you have come out with a new edition of Voice Male, the book that we interviewed you about several years ago. First, what's been added to the book?
Well, there's been a number of developments in the last few years, and I think that some of it has to do with men responding to, and some of our writers responding to, the shifting understanding of sexual assault and presidential misogyny, or presidential candidates' misogyny. So some of that is showing up in the new edition. And also some positive works by some younger men who have been involved in actively working on college campuses to shift the consciousness among young men as to what respect and consent means in regards to sexual relationships and dating and that whole realm.
So since we last talked, the Me Too movement has happened. What was your first reaction to the Harvey Weinstein moment?
Well, it was two things. Of course, I was appalled. I was angry. I felt like this is such a provocative example of male privilege and male entitlement writ large, and that the takedown happened so fully and completely was a sign that there has been a cultural shift. Now, when I say that, I don't necessarily mean that it's a permanent cultural shift, because I think we're still finding out whether this is a reckoning or whether there's going to be some backlash, because after all, we still have a sexual predator holding the highest office in the land. The other thing that occurred to me when this movement started was how it was being covered and how the national conversation was being engaged in. And one of the things that I noted early on was that the media in particular, and a lot of the commentators, were focusing in on individual stories and putting up the names and the profiles of these individual men, rather than asking the question about the system that produces men like them. And that system, of course, is patriarchy. And for me, until or unless we're willing to engage in that conversation about the deconstruction of patriarchy, then this movement may not develop the roots that I think it rightly deserves.
Talk a little bit more about that, about patriarchy and how you see it as the fundamental question to this issue.
Men, like fish not seeing the water in which they swim, men don't experience an understanding of the privilege and entitlement we have just for showing up on the planet in male-identified bodies. And it's taken a long time, and it's taken several iterations of the women's movement over centuries, including our most recent wave, to bring attention to this disparity, to this unlevel playing field. And it's quite clear that from the behavior of the men who have engaged in these sexual predatory practices and the elaborate cover-ups and the payoffs and the hiring of former Mossad agents, that they understood very well that privilege and entitlement and power can sustain itself as long as they have privilege, entitlement, and power. And where we're seeing this privilege and power being attacked or being undermined is through the collective voices of so many women across so many industries. And I think it's important to note here that in this story where the famous women and the glitzy industries that people pay attention to in entertainment and media, they're the tip of this iceberg. I think more and more stories are going to come out of the insurance buildings and the doctor's offices and the supermarket back rooms and all of the other places where we're not getting the full story, because this is an epidemic that's been going on, but it's being propped up by this false sense of privilege and entitlement that over the long term we're seeing can't sustain itself. And I say that with a little caveat that we as a culture can't just assume that this is going to fix itself. It's taken a long time to get to this moment. It's taken a long time for women to be believed. And it's also taken a long time for there to be a glimmer of recognition that there have been men and male allies who've been working on this issue for a really long time.
And talking about male allies now, you wrote a recent post, hashtag men too, men need to stand up in the age of Trump. So you write that sexual assault is not a women's issue. It's a men's issue and a community issue. So tell us, what can men do to support the hashtag Me Too movement?
Well, there are a lot of things that men can do. But the first thing that I want to say is, out of the horror and the struggle of this terrible problem, another piece of the story that's gone underreported is that there have been men working on this issue for a long time. So in addition to the story missing the fact that we need to be addressing the system of patriarchy, the other side of that is that we need to be acknowledging that for 40 years that there have been men who have been allies to and collaborating with women and women's organization. And that when I read post after post saying, where are the men? Where are the men? I'm saying we need to have more men, but a lot of men have been doing this work for several decades. And happily, for those who are wondering, what can men do and why are men feeling tongue-tied as to how to get into the conversation, we have a lot of resources that already exist, a lot of organizations that already exist, a lot of initiatives and campaigns that already exist. And the magazine that the book grew out of, Voicemail, that I've been editing for over 20 years, we're looking at this next issue to be a kind of people's guide to the anti-sexist men's movement, where we will be providing resources from campaigns to books, from Films to Initiative, so that anybody who does want to find their voice and leave the sidelines of indifference will be able to turn to something as simple as the pages of a magazine and get a jump start on ways that they can plug in.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, I'm speaking with pro-feminist man Rob Okun about what men can do to support the Me Too movement. You know, I hear and I understand it, that a lot of men are, you know, they're confused now. They saw themselves as good guys, you know, but they're wondering if they were, you know, if they practice sexual harassment also. They don't know how to flirt, for example, or whether that's even allowed. Some people say this is going to actually hurt women because men are going to be afraid to work with women. What would you say to a man who sincerely comes to you and says, I don't know how to think about this, and I don't know how to think about if I'm attracted to a woman, what do I do?
Well, I mean, I'm smiling because I think people figuring out how to be with each other in relationships has been, you know, going on as long as there have been people. And this is regardless of whether these are heterosexual relationships or any other kind of relationship. What's the watchword? Respect. What's the energy? What are you seeing in the energy? I don't think that this is that hard of a question for men to ask themselves. Have I been engaged in objectifying women my whole life? I didn't know how I was being socialized. I didn't choose to have these privileges foisted upon me. But once I had them, I did have an opportunity to question them. But if I start a relationship with someone and it's coming from a place of, I have expectations about what you're going to do for me, that I'm dominant and you're subservient, and that's kind of the unspoken beginnings, then the objectification is going to be there. I think starting with, how do I want to be in a relationship? And those conversations could be happening among men. Too many of us, when we start to delve into our inner lives a little bit, feel more comfortable in having conversations about matters of the heart with people that we think can hear us best. And that's, for straight men, that's women. And one of the things that can come out of this time is for more men to be engaged in conversations with each other, and for at least some of the men in those conversations to be ready to exercise the courage to speak up if the conversation starts to devolve into objectifying and catcalling and demeaning women. But I don't think it's that hard if men start from a place of, I want to be in a relationship that's mutual and that's respectful. And flirting and checking in to see where the feelings are, that isn't that hard if we're really paying attention to being honest with ourselves.
Now, Zephyr Teachout wrote, I thought, a very thoughtful op-ed in the New York Times that said, I'm not convinced Franken, referring to Al Franken, should quit. She said that while she cares passionately about hashtag Me Too and believes in zero tolerance, she says that something went wrong with his ouster. And she says it has to do with due process and proportionality. So I wonder if you could address that, those two issues, due process and proportionality, in terms of the response to the kind of increased awareness of sexual harassment and the response to it.
Yeah, that's a good example, and that's a good question because, you know, Senator Franken had been a great champion of women and women's rights and had been an effective senator and a voice for causes that a lot of people on the progressive side of the ledger feel strongly about. Did he act like a entitled, dumb, privileged white man when he was, you know, doing his comedy tours and posing for pictures at state fairs? Absolutely. what it looked like was going to happen, and what a lot of people felt was the appropriate thing to happen, was for there to be a full investigation by the Senate Ethics Committee, and then some conclusions drawn and some decisions made, which could have included calling for his resignation, or could have stripping him of some committee chairs or committee positions, or censuring him. So I would agree that in the initial rush to judgment, that there was no discernment, and it was all about, you know, get these guys out of here. And I've heard that phrase, he took one for the team, being the Democrats, the cost that the Democrats were willing to pay so that they would retain the upper hand on the ethics side of this question, since down the road from the halls of Congress sits a president who has tarnished that office to so many degrees. But I think at the core, it's his sexism and misogyny that was put in at center stage.
Yeah, and so now back to some of the work that pro-feminist men, as you write about them, have been doing, the pro-feminist men's movement. You've been involved with an internationalization of this, in fact. It's gone global. Talk about the Men Engage Alliance.
The Men Engage Alliance started about 20 years ago, and it's looking at the level of involvement that has been happening in various parts of the world. North America did not have a lock on pro-feminism. And at this point, there are about 700 NGOs operating in some 70 countries around the world, where there have been some of the most innovative programs working with fathers in Brazil and South Africa. There's a campaign called Men Care that's looking at effective fathering programs in 45 countries, I think, at this point. There have been gender-based violence workshops and trainings that have been happening in South Asia. India really woke up after the horrific rape of the medical student on that bus in New Delhi about 6 years ago. And men have been active around the country to step up into this movement. So a few years ago, I was gathering in New Delhi, a second symposium on engaging men and boys for gender justice, and there were 1,200 delegates from 95 countries. And I was happy that Voicemail, the magazine, was in every tote bag of all the participants. And what we saw was that women's organization and men working in women's organization and men's organizations from around the world, we saw that we're rowing in the same direction, that we're thinking about this question of gender equality, and not just from a place of men have to now stop being involved in issues and turn over leadership, but to recognize that we need to be accountable to women and women's organization. If I haven't said this already, the pro-feminist men's movement exists because of women's work and the women's movement, and that what we have to recognize is that there is now a global movement, and Men and Women works closely with, is spearheading and coordinating a lot of the activities. It's demonstrating that principles of equality among the genders and the direction that we want to see for a Me Too movement becoming a We Did It movement, that this is not limited to North America, but this is now an international campaign for raising consciousness about the rights of women and the place that men can have in a world where equality and egalitarianism doesn't have to be giving up power, but it's sharing power.
Well, this has been just terrific to get the update from you, Rob Okun. You have a new edition of the book Voicemail, that's M-A-L-E, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
It's been a pleasure, Francesca.
Rob Okun has been dedicating himself to the pro-feminist cause since the early 1980s. He was a founder of the Men's Resource Center for Change in Amherst, Massachusetts, and started that organization's magazine, Voice Male, M-A-L-E, in 1982. In 2014, we spoke with him about the book he edited, comprised of articles from Voice Male magazine. Voicemail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement, is now out in a new edition. Let's hear an excerpt from that 2014 interview with Rob Okun about the book. I started out our conversation by asking Rob Okun to define pro-feminism.
Pro-feminism is really, from my perspective, it's men supporting the concept of feminism and all of that entails. I mean, I use the term pro-feminism as opposed to feminist man or male feminist because, as my colleague, the sociologist Michael Kimmel, has said, you know, feminist involves the empirical observation that women and men are not equal in either the private or the public sphere. And it also recognizes that while men may agree with that kind of an assessment of women's subordinate status, and men may want to work towards equality, men can believe in feminism, but to be a feminist requires another ingredient, the felt experience of oppression. And that's something that men can't feel because men aren't oppressed, but are privileged by sexism. So being a pro-feminist is certainly keeping in the same spirit the values and the visions of feminists, but recognizing that as men, that term of declaring oneself a feminist is reserved, in my estimation, for women.
Now, you've been involved in the pro-feminist movement for a long time, at least since 1983, if not before. You were one of the founders of the Men's Resource Center in Amherst, Massachusetts. How did you find yourself as part of, and even in some ways a pioneer of this movement, at least the latter, this more modern phase of the pro-feminist movement? What in your own personal history brought you to this point?
The portal for me, the doorway that I came through most assertively was by becoming a father. And while it isn't essential for every man to be a father to recognize the value of embracing a pro-feminist position, I think in the 3 decades or so that I've been a dad, that my responsibilities and my accessing the nurturing side of myself really awaken something that I think is in most men, is in all men when we're born, innately, you know, arriving on the planet with a clean slate. But I'm a writer and an editor, and I used to do a lot of radio commentaries. And when my children were small, I would write essays and do radio commentaries about the experience of being a dad. That was one strand that led me into this work. I think the other thing that happened for me was in the early 80s, I became aware of what was called feminist art, some of the work that Miriam Shapiro or Judy Chicago were doing. And I sort of was always interested in socially engaged art in general. And when I started to look at women's experiences in making art that addressed their circumstances, that kind of awakened another piece of the story. And then maybe the other component was a little bit of envy as I saw women in women's groups dropping in deep, having rich and meaningful conversations that explored their interior lives. I felt, as a lot of men did, a hunger for that, which initially might have been masked by some insecurity and confusion about where are all these women going off and having these gatherings together and what about me and, you know, doesn't one's partner have the capacity to be all things to all, you know, to their partner. So I think there was a lot of strands. I kind of told it in a inverse way, leading with the fatherhood piece. But I think that was the one
that consistently allowed me to want to grow and explore my own interior life.
Now, you started Voicemail in 1983, part of the Men's Resource Center. Talk about the Men's Resource Center. What was behind the founding of the center? What was its goal?
The pro-feminist men's movement, which, you know, really started in the 70s, started having annual conferences, and the Men's Resource Center, a group of guys from Western Mass went to the conference. It was out in at Tufts, and they saw that there was this kind of a split between some of the people who were talking about social change issues and some of the people who were talking about personal growth issues. And rather than feeling that there was something contradictory about that, they came back, and this was, you know, if this was the top of the first inning, I guess I showed up around the top of the second. And they came back and recognized that we don't have to feel some split, that we can be both and. So I always loved our tagline, which was supporting men and challenging men's violence, which at the face of it could seem contradictory. How can you both be supporting men and challenging men's violence when we saw them as both, you know, the two wings of a dove? And so in those early days, there was as much interest in support groups, men socializing, hanging out, looking at some of the issues that were coming up in our personal lives. And this is the really important part that I think distinguishes the pro-feminist men's movement from some of the other groups that are part of their own definition of a men's movement. There was this deep recognition that there was an epidemic of violence being perpetrated against women out in the culture, and that maybe only a minority of men were perpetrating that violence, but for the majority of us to stand silently by was some form of colluding with that. And from the beginning, the efforts in building this men's resource connection, as it was initially called, was really aimed towards addressing both issues, that we could look at our interior lives, but also had a responsibility to address the problems in the external world.
Rob Okun, talking on Writer's Voice about his book Voicemail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement, in 2014. He's just published a new edition, updated for 2018. After the break, we celebrate the life of Ursula K. Le Guin. Stay tuned.
No one ever will, if I don't say something, if I just lie still. Would I be a monster, scare them all away, if I let them hear what I have to say? I can't keep quiet, no, 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 no. I can't keep quiet, no, 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 no. Oh, one woman rides.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The great science fiction and fantasy pioneer Ursula K. Le Guin passed away on January 23rd at the age of 88. I spoke with Le Guin in 2012 about her two-volume short story retrospective, The Unreal and The Real. Let's hear that interview now. I first encountered science fiction writer Ursula K. Le Guin when I was 19, and it changed my life. The book was The Left Hand of Darkness, published in 1968. It portrays a society where gender is fluid. On the planet Gethin, people can become female or male at different times of their lives, but most of the time, they're neuter. The book blew my mind, maybe because I was just beginning to challenge the stifling definitions of femininity that had hampered me and so many other young women who grew up during the 1950s and 60s. Over the 50-some years that she's been writing speculative fiction, Ursula K. Le Guin has created vivid alternative worlds that challenge traditional notions of gender, social power, religion, sexuality, and ethnic identity. She's explored these themes also in stories that take place on Earth, albeit sometimes in imaginary countries. Now Le Guin has selected 40 from her more than 100 short stories for a new two-volume set out from Northampton, Massachusetts-based publisher Small Beer Press. The first volume is Where on Earth, which includes 18 of her satirical, political, and experimental Earthbound stories. The second, Outer Space, Inner Lands, brings together many of her most loved science fiction stories. Some are from her body of work set in the Ecumen universe, the Galactic Federation to which the planet Gethin of the Left Hand of Darkness belongs. Ursula K. Le Guin is the author of numerous works of fiction and poetry, including The Wizard of Earthsea, The Left Hand of Darkness, and The Lathe of Heaven. Given that her newest collection is entitled The Unreal and the Real, I asked her if there's actually much of a difference between the two.
No, there's not. And that's one reason why I chose that title, The Unreal and the Real, and put it in kind of backwards order because we're more likely to say the real and the unreal, you know. I'm kind of challenging the reader to decide what I mean real. A real country, how real are most countries we haven't been to us, and so on. Yeah. I don't know, it's just sort of, I'm playing games a little bit.
Well, you play some pretty delightful games with, I think, the idea of what fiction and your fiction is. In fact, you say that in your introduction, you say we need a whole new discourse on fiction because you don't really like the categories into which fiction has been placed. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, of course, it sort of goes back to what you said, that you, like most people, think of me, if you know me at all, as a science fiction writer, or, God help us, a sci-fi writer, as sort of not dealing with the grim realities of existence and so on. And if there was ever very much truth to that, and there's some, that truth is kind of leaching away. The genres are mixing back into the so-called mainstream, or vice versa. And we're getting more writers, well, like Michael Chabon is my favorite example, of mixing it all back in together so that this sort of domination of absolute realism, it doesn't hold anymore. It doesn't hold water anymore. I think we've kind of worked through it.
And in fact, there have always been writers who have crossed those boundaries. Isn't that right?
Oh, yeah. But they kind of, you know, they were, particularly in America, they were kind of herded into the genres for many years. And then when you got writers that sort of were obviously couldn't be called sci-fi writers and sort of dismissed, not reviewed, well, let's say like Jorge Luis Borges. Well, he's foreign, so he's foreign and he can get away with it and still be literature. But if you wrote fantasy or science fiction or anything like it in the United States when I started writing, you were immediately genreified and read out. It wasn't literature. And the major reviewers would not review it. And the major prizes do not go to it. So I have to, you know, when I broke into The New Yorker, that was kind of a big step both for me and for science fiction, or whatever it is I write.
And what did you break into The New Yorker with?
I'm sorry?
What was the story?
I break in with? There's several stories in that collection that The New Yorker first published. One of them was one of the Orsinian stories, these stories that take place in my invented Central American country. Like, a lot of my fiction is simply not really very identifiable as, you know, this is science fiction or this is fantasy as we think of it now. They're kind of in between and mixed around.
Well, you can think of, like, the Terry Pratchett, is that his name? Kind of science fiction, the kind of fantasy that is just, you know, purely entertainment.
Yeah, sure.
But
there's always been stuff like that, yeah.
And but your work, to me, I've thought of it as speculative fiction, even before I knew the term, because it was always asking, what if? What if you had a society, for example, like with The Left Hand of Darkness, which was the first book I read of yours and completely knocked my socks off. What if you had a society in which people became both men and women at different times in their lives? I mean, that was such an amazing concept to wrap one's mind around. Could you talk a little bit about
that? It was fairly new in 1968, I can tell you.
Yeah, and I think that's probably when I read it, as a matter of fact. The very notion that you could have a society like that, and then it appears again in this collection as well, in two different stories in a way, some of those ideas. Your stories seem to be a lot about power and power relationships, particularly as they relate to gender, but not only.
Yeah, isn't a lot of fiction, aren't a lot of novels kind of about who has the power and how they use it?
Yeah, but not as social commentary.
Well, I'm not sure. It can be the power within a family, after all. Or, well, okay, take somebody as kind of lightweight and seemingly innocent as Trollope's, his novels about the English clergy. There are huge power struggles going on in those novels. They're on a very small scale. I think, you know, power or status, whatever you want to call it, which of course includes gender relationships, is kind of one of the major ways that novels approach relationships. I'll tell you, Francesca, the reason I kind of resist a term like speculative fiction is it sounds so intellectual. You know, you speculate in your mind. Well, sure, and that's, I love it, and I love reading books to do, and I love writing that kind of thing. But science fiction, no good fiction is written straight from the head. It's got to involve the emotions and the body. You know, speculating makes it sound like you have to kind of be intellectual to read it, mm-hmm. so I kind of struggle against that a bit.
Right, and I can understand that, although I would certainly never accuse your novels of not being emotionally powerful. So
good.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, I can say that The Left Hand of Darkness and The Dispossessed changed my life because they opened me up in a path. And I can't even tell you much about the plot of either anymore because it's been decades since I've read them.
Plot is not my strong point, I can tell you.
but they had a powerful emotional impact on me because they opened up my vision to the idea that society could, in fact, be different than what it is. And I think that's what I found not unique in your work. There are other people who have written about that, but I think you've been one of the greatest practitioners of that, of imagining a whole new way that people could construct the way they relate to each other in society.
I suppose doing that is one of the major ways in which both fantasy and science fiction are kind of important or essential in what they're doing is precisely in offering an alternative vision. It may not be a very happy one. It may not be an alternative you want to go to, you know, like all the dystopian novels, but all imaginative fiction sort of says, you know, it doesn't have to be exactly the way it is. And that is very important. I think one reason why imaginative fiction is very important to adolescents is they're looking for, you know, for ways out and different ways to do things. And that fiction can come along just at that right moment and sort of say, yes, it's legitimate to think that way. There might be another way to handle the relations of the sexes or whatever it is we're talking about.
And can I ask you, where did that idea come from? Just the way you constructed, maybe tell our listeners a little bit about the people in The Left Hand of Darkness. Do you mind?
No, I wrote it a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I hope I can remember. Well, they are fully human, except their whole sexuality is different in that they are for most of the month genderless. They are neither male nor female, and they have no sexual desires or proclivities. And then they go into heat, as it were. Once a month, they have the potentiality to be either male or female, and then it gets kind of complicated because it depends on, for instance, if they're with a person who's, it's called going into kemmer. If the other person is in kemmer as a male, they will almost inevitably develop as a female for a few days. And then they are very highly sexually motivated. So somebody in the book speculates that perhaps since they live on a very difficult planet with a very cold climate where life is hard, maybe this makes it a little more certain that they'll have children, you know, that they will sort of always go into heat together. And the female will always be receptive to the male. But the thing is, the way it works out is, of course, you can be both a father and a mother. And so society is somewhat different than our society. And I was, back in 1968, I was a little bit timid, actually, working out exactly how it would differ, how the society would differ. The one thing I was pretty sure of, it seems to come forth, was that they did not have war in the sense we do. They did not have large, organized aggression. They just killed each other by ones and twos.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with science fiction master Ursula K. Le Guin about the unreal and the real, the new two-volume set of some of her best-loved short stories. And that shows up again in one of the stories here. There's a link in the story in the second volume, which is Outer Space, Inner Lands. You have the story Betrayal. And one of the characters is reading in a book about these very people. And it says, on Gethin, there has never been a war. And this is a planet where there has been a slave rebellion that has overthrown the slave masters, and yet war has continued. Could you talk a little bit about this story, Betrayal?
It came from a book called Four Ways to Forgiveness, which is a kind of a set of linked novellas. I got this sort of vision in my head of this. It's a pair of planets, one colonized the other, and it's a slave society. And just for the hell of it, I made the slaves white and the masters black, as it were, just because I like to turn things upside down that way. And I guess the reason that the whole trying to think out slavery, and I sort of think through writing fiction. My mind works best if I'm making up a story. It's how I think. I was trying to think, what is involved in slavery? What does it feel like? If you've been a slave, really a slave, and you do work free, what is that like? What is it like to own slaves, to be a slave master or mistress? So I guess a lot of my novels and stories are thought experiments. I'm trying to think things out by personifying them, making them real in a story.
Which is what I meant when I said speculative fiction. It's a whole what if. And you do it so marvelously. I mean, there's in this story, the betrayal, I loved it. You know, you have... I don't know how much you want me to... I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot to necessarily have a spoiler about in it.
But, oh, no. No,
so
there, as I say, my plots are not important.
Right. And I also wonder, you talk about some of your stories being geriatric realism. I thought of this as geriatric unrealism. because you have two old people. Who are both fleeing the world. One comes from a position of relatively little power. One was the former ruler of the planet after the slave rebellion, had been the ruler of the slave rebellion. And you find them gingerly approaching each other. It's a really lovely, lovely story. You know, I was just very affected by their relationship to each other. Could you talk a little bit about developing that line of the story?
I'm not sure how intelligently I can talk about it, because that was, like so many of my stories, the character, the point of view character, the woman, who, from my point of view, those people are not so very old. I think she's 60-ish and he's 65-ish, which is possibly adolescent from where I am now. But anyway, the character sort of comes into my head, and with her situation and kind of who she is, and that she's gone off to try to sort of meditate and enter the last stage of her life properly, you know, according to her religion. And she meets up with this man whom she actually hated passionately because he was sort of a dictator who took over a revolution. And she believed in the revolution and not in the dictator, you know. So there's a, although they never knew each other, there's a kind of a enmity towards him in her heart. And yet, she finds this, but he is a man. He's just a person. He's not a dictator anymore. And it's kind of against her will, almost. They form a relationship which grows into a somewhat troubled loving relationship. So I was just kind of following these people who, both of whom, as you say, are kind of off on the edge of things and have put themselves or been put into rather extreme loneliness. I write a lot about lonely people.
And why is that?
I don't know. They're interesting. I think introverts are much more interesting than extroverts.
Yeah.
That might be, that could be prejudice, you know.
Yeah, you say something about that in your introduction, that we live in a society that's so extrovert-centric.
It is. It values extroversion. It seems to me it overvalues it a bit. There is a story in there called Solitude, which is my sort of the introvert's revenge. I imagine a woman who is deeply introverted just by nature and who achieves her kind of paradise. And that was fun to write. And, you know, when you watch everybody going by with some sort of communicating instrument clamped to their ears and mouth, you kind of wonder, doesn't anybody ever want to just walk through the streets and look, listen
yeah.
anymore, you know?
You see, I think...
Do we have to be talking to each other all the time?
I think you put your finger right on it, if I may digress from talking about your books for just a minute, because actually when you are alone, I find you're much more open to the world that is around you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. When you go for a walk with a friend, if you start talking, you kind of lose... The beach or the mountain or wherever you're walking, you know, and you go into the relationship and the conversation. But to really see, you sort of have to be quiet.
Exactly. And actually, it seems to me that writers need to be observers. Good writers, if they're going to write the kind of emotionally powerful work that you do, Ursula K. Le Guin, you have to be an observer.
Yeah. I think a lot of writers really need silence. And now that writers are supposed to all rush out and sell themselves continuously because the publishers have sort of ceased to do so, it's harder for writers to find the kind of the room of one's own that Virginia Woolf talked about.
Yes.
And, you know, when you say a room of your own, you mean a quiet room, a room where the only noise is the noise you want.
That's true. Now, there's another story in this collection, again in Volume 2. And this one also, I think, is in the Haynish cycle. It's The Matter of Segre.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking with Ursula K. Le Guin about her new collection of stories, a new book, two volumes, The Unreal and the Real. Volume 1 is Where on Earth? Volume 2 is Outer Space, Inner Lands. And in that second volume, The Matter of Segre, you said something before about how you like to turn things on their head. And this one also very much turns things on their head. It's about a society in which women have all the power, but none of the glory, and men have all the glory, but none of the power.
That is a sort of classically science fictional story in its origin. It is, you know, a bit of a puzzle why there are as many men as there are women, or why there are as many female cats as there are, as many male cats as there are female cats. because you don't need that many males to keep the females reproducing. Look at your average flock of chickens. One rooster and 20 hens, right?
Yeah.
That is, and that works fine. So why are there so many males? And it actually is not a question that has a definite answer given by science. So I just imagined a world where that, for whatever reason, that proportion didn't hold, and that males are quite rare and therefore extremely valued. And yet they're not enough of them to dominate the society the way they dominate, as far as we know, all extant Earth societies. So what would you get if you had a society where there was maybe one male child grew to adulthood? So how would, well, of course, you can think of 100 ways they might handle that, but so I just thought of one and made a rather grim set of little short stories about it.
You also deal with the issue, though, of identity, you know, gender identity versus individual identity in this story, something you take up in another story as well, although not from the gender point of view. That story's Nine Lives. I'll just quote from one of the characters in The Matter of Segre. This is after this society has been contacted by the Ecumen, is that how?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
By the Ecumen, this confederation of planets. They have been contacted. They know their society is in some ways unusual. And this character says, maybe in a few more decades we'll decide we should remake ourselves. In other words, we should genetically engineer us so that we have a more equal balance between the sexes. But she says she doesn't want to be alive then. She likes our people, our fierce, proud, beautiful men. I don't want them to become like women. I like our trustful, powerful, generous women. I don't want them to become like men. And yet I see that among you, that is the others from the Ecumen, each man has his own being and nature. Each woman has hers. This is a very interesting counterpoint between how we structure identity as an individual and as part of the group.
Good, because that's exactly what I wanted it to be. In a sense, I've tried in various ways to kind of shake up our fixed belief that there is a gender identity and that it is kind of eternal and God-given and must not be changed and so on. Since, I mean, any study of anthropology can tell you that gender is constructed rather differently in different places, even on Earth. And since gender is not constructed very well in our society in many ways, it's very hard. I think it's unnecessarily hard both on men and on women. As a fiction writer, I enjoy just shaking up the mixture and finding what comes out.
I told Ursula K. Le Guin that one of the stories that most surprised and delighted me was about a being that seemed very much like a mouse in a laboratory.
A rather small alien being who is unfortunately has a very highly specialized diet, kind of like our koala bears do. You know, koalas can only eat eucalyptus, which in the long run is not a very good idea for the survival of the species. It's a first contact story, to use the science fictional technical term, you know, when a first contact between Earth people and some other species. And so the scientist who is studying this rather small alien treats it may resemble something a bit mouse-like, because he treats it kind of like a little rodent, puts it in a maze. And he gives it the right kind of food, but unfortunately the food is dead. The animal can live only on living food, which is also true of certain Earth organisms. But of course, you know, in the larger sense, Francesca, it sort of is a mouse. I'm putting the reader into the point of view of a mouse in a scientist's laboratory.
Right. And this mouse, I mean, the maze is a whole marvelous construct that is religious and spiritual and intellectual and social for the mouse. You know, I just love to read something about it. For example, he says the second maze was a kind of simple version of the ungated affirmation, quite adequate for the reassuring, outreaching statement I wanted to make. I mean, it's just lovely to conceive of the maze as a kind of language and construct.
Yeah, no, you see, that came to me from my little space alien mouse when I began communicating through fiction with it, that these people, and they are people because this is obviously a highly intelligent creature, they communicate through dance. Their language is dance, and that is what the poor scientist who's totally verbally fixated, the language is has to be verbal, you know, he cannot see that the little alien is wildly attempting to communicate, and the Earth scientist is attempting to communicate with the alien because it sort of intuits there's some intelligence here, but I don't get it. Both of them, one dies of frustration. The other just ends up kind of brokenhearted. He never could figure out his little creature.
Yeah, he tries to deal with the creature through a kind of Skinnerian, you know, pushing the levers to get food or an electrical charge. Well,
let's hope when we really do meet some space aliens that we're not stuck in that kind of mechanical version of communication.
And so I'm going to come back to my first question somewhere along in the beginning, where you say we need to have a new discourse on fiction. What would that new discourse be if you were, you know, emceeing the conversation?
Well, coming from where I come from, I would like critics and teachers, academic particularly, to sort of get over modernism and the idea that the only good fiction is realistic. It never was true, and it's getting less and less true now. Realism, as we know it, is not really capable of handling some of the realities that we live in now.
What do you mean?
Well, just what I say, that I think realistic fiction, as we've conceived it, which is increasingly, at least in this country, coming down to the unhappinesses of dysfunctional suburban families, that is a very narrow approach to existence, and it's been pretty well worked over. And I think the interesting writing that's being done is way off on other margins and edges of what was considered central to fiction. This is not to denigrate the great works of 20th century fiction like The Grapes of Wrath. But then, on the other hand, look at the subject of The Grapes of Wrath. It is not suburban discontent. I think the fiction that is considered to be serious fiction now has become rather repetitive and perhaps rather unadventurous. Fiction can do anything, like poetry, you know. So let's go.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And the collection is The Unreal and the Real, and we've been speaking with Ursula K. Le Guin. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca.
Ursula K. Le Guin. She passed away January 23rd at the age of 88. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.